Atheist Nomads, episode 232, Emancipation of a Black Atheist.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and I have Lauren with me.
Hello.
Just barely.
And Kylie.
And
in my ribs.
We're recording this on November 26th, and it isn't going up until January 2. So, Happy New Year. And this is the last week of our parental leave from the show. So, we'll be back with the normal content in just one more week. So, look forward to that. We have a quick sponsor break, and then we will get to the interview. Atheist Nomads is proudly brought to you by Archway Hosting. Check out their low-price, full-featured hosting solutions at archwayhosting.com. That's A-R-C-H-W-A-Y hosting.com. We're also brought to you by listeners just like you. You can find out how you can become a patron at patreon.com/atheistnomads. That's patreon.com/atheistnomads. And we are joined now by Dr. D.K. Evans, Ph.D., has a doctorate in higher education, has a book that, as of release, will have just been released, called Emancipation of a Black Atheist, and is a author and speaker. D.K., welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Thanks for having me, Dustin. I'm excited about it.
And is that your preferred way to be called, D.K.?
Yeah, you can go by D.K. or go by Dov, either way.
Dov, okay. So, Dov, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, let's see. I live in Mooresville, North Carolina. I am a corporate trainer. In my second profession, if you will. For the first half of my career, I was in higher education. And like I said, now I'm in corporate training. I love what I do. And on the side, I love writing as well. So it was almost kind of accidental how I kind of stumbled onto this particular topic for this book, Emancipation of a Black Atheist. And that's kind of what I do on the side when I'm not training. I've just been writing, researching, writing, and speaking about this particular book and all the experiences I've had with it.
Okay. And with your day job, what kind of corporate training do you do?
So,
do you use the word synergize a lot?
I do not, actually.
Darn.
I do not. You know, yeah, I know, right? That's a word that...
No buzzwords?
I've heard a lot of other trainers use it, and I just can't use it. It's almost like on my do not say list. I can't say that. Or piggyback. I don't like piggyback as well. That's another one I don't say a lot.
Synergize is just so 90s.
Right. It is. I'm sure it was a nice buzzword, and to say it meant like, ooh, you know, they're about something. They just said synergize, but yeah, I can't use that one. So I typically train on a variety of topics, but with this particular position, I train a lot on leadership and management and strategic planning. I do a lot of that as well. That's my main focus.
Okay.
I would say my passion. Yeah.
So a lot of how to do what the corporate overlords tell you to do without being a complete asshole.
Right. Yeah. Something like that. A lot of that. And just really just trying to change perceptions and attitudes as well. So I know how it feels to be at the bottom of the totem pole. I know exactly what that's like. So trying to talk to other employees who are in that current position, who, you know, treat their job just like a 9-to-5 and, you know, see it as a dead end career, if you will, but trying to help them find other opportunities to kind of navigate their career, make the most out of what they have right now. So they can not necessarily even ascend to in the current corporation, but maybe, you know, whatever it is they want to do, whether they want to write or be an artist or whatever they want to do, just kind of knowing that whatever they're doing now is essentially a stepping stone to get them to where they want to be next. So, you know.
That is wise.
Is it?
I was just thinking about my own career. It's like, oh man, yeah.
Yeah.
Stepping stones to somewhere else.
Yeah. Right. Basically, every job really is until you retire. And even your last job is just a stepping stone to retirement.
Absolutely. But I feel like we don't realize that until hindsight though. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I can look back in my 20s and go, yeah, like a lot of what I did back then really prepared me for what I wrote about now, what I'm speaking about now, what I'm doing in my, you know, in my career. But you don't realize it when you're in the moment. So just really helping them realize, you know, the moment that they're in until it's, you know, before it's too late and they have a bunch of shoulda, coulda, wouldas.
Mm.
And given the current, let's say, cultural climate we're in right now, And you're in the South. Do you encounter much racism in your job?
I wouldn't say in my job. Out in the community, yes, but not at my job. I wouldn't say as much. I think not at my job because for me, it's more of a controlled environment. I'm able to, and this is me kind of guessing just based on what I've seen throughout my career, I'm able to establish more of a reputation. So I think people can respect me as an individual. But if I'm out in the community and I'm just that guy, then I would assume that's probably why I would see it more in the community than at my job specifically.
So the difference between the guy in a suit that the higher ups have paid a lot of money to talk to these people versus a random guy on the street.
Right.
Okay. Right. Yeah. It's amazing the difference that context and even just attire can have.
Right. Absolutely. And I can't help but to look at, not even just attire, but just age as well. Like I see it with, like with my sons, like I'll be walking around, you know, with my sons in the communities and everybody, you know, like, oh, he's so cute. You know, my two boys, oh, they're so cute. And, again, their ages, you know, 5 and 3. And I can't help but to think like, what might they, you know, what perceptions might they have of those boys like 10 years from now when they're 15 and 13, you know, is that going to change? And if so, you know, how's that going to affect them? Because because they hear these compliments, you can see their reaction, you know, they're pretty well-behaved. They're in the store, just, you know, minding their business. And they're like, oh, your kids are so cute. They're so well-behaved, so well-mannered. And I can't help but to think 10 years from now, you know, if they're doing the same thing, just kind of minding their business, will the people in the community have that same perception or will it change simply because they look closer to, you know, older men now, you know? So I always wonder that. And again, that's me kind of projecting and thinking ahead, but those are some of the things that kind of race through my head as I not only think about my personal experience, but the experience of, for my kids and the conversations I'm going to have to have with them, especially the 5-year-old is becoming more and more, you know, vocal with his precocious nature, just trying to figure out how to navigate answering his questions without going over his head and without scaring him, you know, just whether it's about anything.
It's a scary conversation to have, but it's one that unfortunately everybody's got to have with their kid.
Right.
Well, not everybody. Those of us with white privilege don't.
Right.
But it's I've read a couple articles with people from that point of view. It's like, got this, you know, beautiful baby boy. What happens when he starts wearing hoodies and carrying backpacks around and people are suspicious and is he going to make it to 18?
Right.
Sad.
He asked me, so my son about a month ago, as a matter of fact, 2 months ago, asked me, he said to me, we were driving, I picked him up from school and the 5-year-old said, are black people bad?
Oh.
And the first thing that ran through my mind is, where did he get that from? That's what I asked him. I said, you know, where'd you get that from? Like who, like, you know, I'm just trying to be curious and I didn't want to scare him to make it sound like it's a bad thing or a good thing. Just really curious to understand where that message came from. And he couldn't remember as they usually don't. They're like, I don't know. And, so every morning I have these things I say to both of them every morning. I talk about what it is to be a leader. I talk about, you know, how your word is your bond, how you carry yourself. I talk about these things every single morning. They know them by heart, literally. So now I'm thinking, do I need to incorporate something about like just what it is to be yourself? And how do I phrase it to a 5-year-old to where it makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to him about, one of the things I always talk to him about already, and this kind of ties back to the book as well, is seeing is believing. I always talk to him about that, you know, like watch people with their actions, you know, don't go off what people say. Seeing is believing. Actions speak louder than words. They know that saying, they say it back to me. So I said, well, how do you know black people bad? Do you think? And he said, I don't know, maybe. And I said, have you seen black people do something bad? And he was like, I don't know. He was like, have you seen anybody else do anything bad? And he was like, sometimes. I was like, well, seeing is believing. You know, like, you know, I want you to have the opportunity to take every individual and base them on their own character. You know, like let their actions speak volumes to you about who that person is, because you need to do the same thing. You know, you need to carry yourself a certain way if you want other individuals to, assuming they're giving you the benefit of the doubt, have a certain perception of you. So, you know, trying to teach them some of these general lessons that I figure, you know, will become more and more focused as they get older. But man, it's kind of put me, you know, kids make you feel so old, you know, like I'm like, man, am I having to explain something like this? You just never think until it comes up.
And right.
So,
you never think that you don't daydream about that when you're holding a newborn about all these future conversations I'm going to have with my kids.
Yeah.
And then they drop a bomb like that and you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, like, oh, okay, let's start with history 200 years ago.
Yeah. Not even, I'm like, wouldn't you rather want to talk about where babies come from or something else? Like, but
what animals you like at the zoo? I mean, come on, kid.
My boss's daughter is a physician's assistant. Her husband is a physical therapist, and they adopted a kid. And when they picked a black boy to adopt, the adoption agency made them take numerous classes to prepare them on how do you raise a kid that you can teach how to not get shot. Because if it was just a white kid in Idaho, you're not going to have to worry about that.
Right.
A black kid, that's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely different. Like I said, I definitely don't even, there's certain aspects of it I don't even realize until I have to explain it back to a 5-year-old. It really makes you go back to basics, if you will. Because there's certain things with adults, you just either assume or you skate over or whatever it is. But with a 5-year-old, you know, they, you know, because of their honesty and the honesty in their questions, they don't let you all the time. They're like, no, well, why? And why is that? And how come? And so you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, man, that's heavy.
Yeah.
All right. So tell us about your book.
Right. So the book, Emancipation of a Black Atheist, it's a book that that came out of nowhere, really. I've written a couple other books before. One was a book about just kind of reinventing the idea of success. And then the other one was a book just I wrote a chapter about leadership. So when I decided to write this book, everybody that knew about my other two books, you know, were like, where did this come from? So essentially I was about 5 years ago, I was, my wife and I were in Nashville. My son was, a newborn at the time. And there's a series of events that led, you know, that happened before I saw this particular interview, but I saw an interview called, Intelligence Squared. Have you heard about that before?
Mm-hmm.
I was watching that. That little debate, if you will, and the topic that happened to be discussing was, is there a God? And I was watching that, and I asked myself for the very first time, why do I believe in God? And I had never asked myself that very basic question before. So with that, I watched the entire interview or the debate, and the debate didn't really have a whole lot of bearing on my, you know, on my particular outcome, except for me asking that particular question. Because, you know, I couldn't remember a whole lot of the details of what they debated about, but that question stuck out. Like, why? I don't even know why. I didn't have a good answer. The best answer I can come up with was, in my head as I'm thinking about it, was, I guess because my mother told me a long time ago, but that was it. That was literally the best I can do. And I was like, if I can't find anything better than that, then this definitely needs some further investigation. Because again, as we talked about with kids, I'm looking ahead, like, well, what would I tell, you know, my son at the time? And I didn't have a good answer. And I did a little bit of research based on some things that I had heard, you know, the past few months, you know, with regard to some individuals I should research. They had some different takes on religion. And after doing that research, one thing led to another. And before I knew it, I was taking notes because I couldn't, you know, keep up with all the different things I was reading and stuff I was looking up online and books I was reading. And like I said, I just amassed this, you know, huge pile of notes. I was taking copious notes every day. And before I knew it, I was like, you know, I might as well turn this into a book. I kind of said it jokingly to my wife. And and then after that, it wasn't a joke anymore. Like, really, I was really upstairs not working on a book. I just finished my PhD and complaining about a dissertation and doing that. It took me about 2 years to finish that dissertation. And I'm like, and I'm thinking, I'm telling my wife, I'm telling everybody, I'm never writing again. This is it.
I was going to say, you decided to jump right back into another project.
I'm a glutton for punishment.
Oh my gosh.
So like, you know, after finishing that, I dive right into writing this book. But it really interests me though, because obviously I didn't have to, but you know, it really interests me. And trying to think about my approach with the book, that's what, that was probably the biggest challenge. And one of the things that really narrowed my focus is, as I kind of alluded to earlier, what would I tell my son? You know, if he asked me, you know, Dad, is there a God? Or, you know, I saw this person praying. What is that? Or, you know, any of those questions, what would I tell them? So I kind of wrote this book to kind of mirror the type of exploration I would, you know, the type of exploration I would hope that, you know, my son and any other kids, you know, I would have at that point. And I wanted to go down that process myself. I didn't want to advise my son on how to do something, and I didn't even do it myself. So I kind of embarked on this exploration of not only looking at my past experiences and looking at the research I was doing, but I actually went out in the community and tried to find other Black atheists and kind of talk to them about their experience as well. You know, what they saw, what they experienced, what made them, what deconverted them, if you will, what that deconversion process was like or experience was like. It was very eye opening because, again, I had my own experience. I had my own thoughts, which is chronicled in the book. But then at the same time, you know, there's some very different experiences, a lot more challenging than mine. I would say most of them a lot more challenging than mine. I thought my situation was challenging. And then after talking to these other individuals, their experience is way more challenging, you know, if I had to rate it, if you will. So I'm glad I got to talk to some other people who went through some different experiences, especially dealing with their family and friends. And it also was eye-opening because I never knew how intertwined, specifically Christianity, not just religion, but Christianity was intertwined in the Black community. I mean, I kind of had a sense, but...
You never really tried to put a number on it?
Right. Yeah. I never really tried to quantify it, you know, if you will. And you all might, you know, have this experience in terms of looking at religion one way when you're part of the faith, then versus when you leave the faith, it is almost like you have a totally different perspective.
Oh yeah.
So
and then wait a few years and it changes again.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I've seen that with other folks too. When they first leave, they're babes to atheists, if you will, to atheism, if you will. And then, you know, then a couple years later, it's like they have a totally different approach to their new point of view. So it was the same thing with me, and it was a journey. And it was great, because it was eye-opening, just learning more about other Black atheists and, you know, contemporary, if you will, you know, Black atheists, as well as throughout history, and have an understanding of a role that they played in historically significant events that we would typically ascribe to Christians, you know, mm-hmm. Black Christians, like civil rights movement, things like that.
Yeah, a lot of that was glossed over.
Right. A lot of that's glassed over. And especially if you're in church, let's say you're sitting in church during Black History Month, you know, you'll often hear a lot about prominent Black figures throughout history. And the ones that happen to be atheists or non-believers or skeptics, you know, so on and so forth, of course, you know, that'll be glossed over. You know, they wouldn't say that, you know, in church, even though, you know, that was, you know, who they were, that was very much a part of who they were, and they were still able to contribute to the Black experience. They were still able to contribute to, you know, gaining equal rights and things of that nature. And I think it's not important to do that because I'm expecting people in the congregation to hear that and then want to convert or considering being atheist, nothing like that. But it's just understanding mm-hmm. that we're not a monolith. You know, we're more diverse than people think. And whether you're in a corporation or, you know, in a small community or a large community, diversity can be a good thing if you know how to leverage it. So understanding that we are diverse and it's okay. It doesn't have to be scary if we're not all Christian. It's still okay.
That's true.
And with the civil rights movement, it would have made sense that most of the leaders would have been pastors because it was very difficult for Black people to get higher education mm-hmm. and to get positions of general social influence.
Right.
And so easiest opportunity to get the education and the standing in the community was to become a pastor.
Mm-hmm. All right. Absolutely. And not only that, though, especially if we're talking about this, you know, during the civil rights movement, it was hard for the movement to really gain traction in the community. And especially, you know, sometimes within churches, because they didn't want to become a target to, you know, white supremacists. You know, they're like, hey, you know, I mean, I like what you're doing, don't get me wrong, but I don't want to draw any negative attention, you know, to ourselves. So we, you know, a lot of them were hesitant. So there was that divide, if you will, you know, with the church being a little hesitant to kind of take that step and go out in the forefront, not all churches, but, you know, but a lot of churches, to go out in the forefront when it comes to the civil rights movement. But, there were a lot of people, that were believers, but as well as non-believers, you know, that actually did kind of take a step, you know, in the right direction when it came to civil rights, putting themselves on the front line, becoming that target, individuals like, you know, James Farmer, you know, again, if you're talking about just throughout history, you know, James Farmer, for example, who was the founder of CORE, and Congress on Radical Equality. Again, you know, he's an individual, for example, who had his father was, you know, had a PhD in theology. So he was very much raised in a household, you know, with religion. So, but even with that, though, you know, his path kind of led, you know, or his journey led him down a different path, which allowed him to still, you know, become free from those shackles, you know, of religion, if you will, but still be a prominent member of the Black community. Right. And, and I think that's not, I know that that's one fear of Black people who are questioning religion. You know, they're quote unquote religious Christian, but they're questioning. But one fear is, man, if I denounce my faith, people are not going to look at me as Black. I'm not really as part of the community. And people throughout history have done this. They were still able to contribute, you know, be prominent members in the Black community. And I feel like if more Black people today knew about them, they'd go, oh, okay, well, I'm not the only one. You can still do that and still be, I can still be Black. I can still participate in my community and still be a prominent member. It doesn't make me any less Black. It doesn't lessen my experience only because I'm not Christian necessarily.
No, you know, absolutely. It's okay. And right. We need that because, we've done a fairly decent job of having targeted white young people to come out, and especially using social media and stuff to declare their atheism or their non-belief. But when you are referring to Latino or Black communities, there's this wall of communication, and it's like we need people to be comfortable with, you know, taking that step out into the world, because nobody else wants to go first.
Right. Right. There's actually a part in the book where I talk about this phenomenon called the prayer closet. Right. So a lot of people who are, you know, coming out as atheists, you might say, hey, I came out of the closet, you know, I'm an atheist. So I kind of took it a step further in the book. And I called it the prayer closet. And there's three walls that kind of entrap the mind, you know, in the prayer closet while you're kind of, still subscribing to Christianity. One of those walls, for example, is tradition. Another one is myth, and another one is fear. And then that fourth wall is more so of a door, which is kind of just, you know, the truth that you walk in, you know, when you walk in that particular door, once you are being brought up, you know, in the Christian faith and being taught, you know, the different value things of that nature of Christianity, but you can choose to walk out, obviously, you know, once you become an atheist. So tradition, you know, one of those walls that kind of enclose you in the prayer closet, is huge. And I think that's one that definitely affects the Black community. And again, I would think it affects any community, but I saw specifically how it affected the Black community just because, again, like it's a part of, or it's supposedly a part of what it is to be Black. Like there's certain things you can say, you know, from one Black person to another, and automatically they would go, no, I don't do that. Like you can say, hey man, you know, let's go snowboarding. Like, don't do that. Now, there's nothing wrong going snowboarding. You know, you do what you want to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, deep down inside, you might actually want to go. But if you're in a certain setting, you might denounce a particular activity or a certain type of music or eating a certain way or whatever it is, just because that's not a part of the experience. And it'd be the same thing I find, you know, with my book. My book itself has been, a very interesting talking piece. So I'll talk to Black people about my book. And if we're in a group setting, more than likely, you know, the group will kind of shut it down. Like, hey, oh, so your wife, you know, my wife, one of my biggest advocates, they're like, so your wife said, you know, you wrote a book. You know, she didn't tell them the details. She just said, wrote a book. So then I say, oh, yeah. And they're like, so what's it about? And I'm like, oh, well, it's about Christianity and religion in the Black community, and kind of chronicles my journey out of the faith. And then silence. It's almost kind of awkward. It's like, okay, so how about them Cowboys? You know, something along those lines, right? But then if I'm like one-on-one with somebody, or maybe just a couple, it's amazing the conversations that we have. All of a sudden, like, you know, man, I've actually asked some questions to myself. That's happened so many times. It's not even funny. Like, I can almost tell you, if I'm one-on-one with another Black person, or maybe it's a couple, it's two friends versus a whole group. Again, the group will look at me like I'm crazy or go silent. That one-on-one interaction, or if it's two people, we're turning into a conversation. It doesn't mean that, you know, they turn into atheists right then, or they become atheists, they change their beliefs, but they definitely start to share a little bit more about their experience, and they definitely articulate more of an open-mindedness that doesn't occur when they're in a group setting. They go, you know what? I've had questions. Or you know what? You know, I know a lot of atheists, or they're just more relaxed about it. You know what? I actually have some questions about that. Tell me more about that. You know, tell me more about your book. It's a completely different experience. So I can tell how you know, based on my interactions and observations, that it just seems like, you know, when you're in that group setting, again, you know, there's like unspoken rules of what it is to be Black. And, you know, being an atheist, that's not Black. You know, now I'm not saying that, I'm just saying that's like the unwritten rule. I want to change that. I would love for that to be changed. Not to necessarily convert Black people, but just understand that it's a different experience. Just like how Black people can love different foods, be from different places, have different accents, everything else. Black people can also be atheists. We do not have to be Christian. It is okay. We can still work on the issues in our community. We can still be prominent members, and we can still get along and things of that nature, and still be atheists at the same time. You know, that's what I want to kind of bring to the forefront. And that's what I would hope, if nothing else, my book would do, a spark a conversation about reaching that particular goal.
And that's when everybody stands up and says, amen.
Yeah, no, and they're like, oops, what's that?
No, it's the group mentality thing is like, it's so not surprising because that's how groups are. But at the same time, that's really surprising, you know, just to actually hear about it.
It's frustrating, too, to some degree, because you see how much religion plays, or Christianity specifically plays, a heavy factor, you know, when it comes to making decisions in our community, you know, especially when it comes to money. I talk about that in the book. Specifically, I talk about these, you know, these pastors, these mega church pastors,
prosperity gospel.
I know there's right. Yeah. Who preach a prosperity gospel. And again, I know, you know, they can come in, you know, they're all over the country, you know, in every color and things of that nature. But for me, I'm just thinking, you know, how much that affects a community, that is still on the come up. You know, we are still in the process of getting to a comfortable point when it comes to areas that we may lack in, whether it's nutrition and education and finance and business ownership and home ownership and things of that nature. And when we look back to an ancient text for the foundation of how we make decisions, you know, essentially that's almost like our playbook. It's just old and outdated. 400 years of, you know, questionable decisions and progress that is, you know, not up to par has got to make us turn around and start to ask some questions about the tactics that we're taking. All that money that gets sunk into these churches every Sunday, there's got to be a better use for those particular resources. There's got to be. If we're lacking in all these areas, tell me we can't, you know, spend money on some of these colleges, some of these HBCUs, you know, that educate our young adults, or we can't spend it to, you know, on educating our community when it comes to nutrition, or on spending it when it comes to business ownership, things of that nature. Yeah. There's so many more avenues we can go with it. And I feel like we're limiting ourselves by putting all our chips in one basket every Sunday.
Like, if you could just like overnight convince everybody to focus on standard of living first,
right,
and then, you know, maybe the extras after, that'd be great.
Yeah.
But
yeah, right.
You know, good luck like with if, that. That's
if like you said, if we were to make that the focus, if we were to make all these areas where we're lacking, you know, the focus, the main focus, and if there's anything left over, you know, then fine. But again, I think, after 400 years, I really think, you know, we should try something new.
Yeah.
And one thing that I saw in researching this book is a lot of the, you know, historically, you know, a lot of these, Black atheists that were, you know, skeptics and non-believers, you know, that were out there kind of paving their way in their own profession, you know, with their own, you know, with their own skills. A lot of them were historians, and I can't help but to think that, and I was a history major in undergrad. And I can't help but to think that there's gotta be something with, you know, studying history, especially, you know, American history, and studying, our introduction, our very tumultuous introduction to Christianity, what that looks like, has gotta be jolting, especially if you were told one thing, you know, like just, there's always been this, Jesus always is, God always is, Christianity always is, unquestioned. But then you read history, and then you get a very different idea of how we were introduced to this ideology, and how it was relevant to a certain extent at the time, almost as like a sedative, to alleviate a mental and physical and emotional pain. And I'm referring to slaves, you know, that obviously they, you know, that they had to experience. But at the same time, at some point, you know, we have to take ourselves off this opiate. You know, we have to get off this drug and say, okay, you know, it slowed us down so much that our production is not where it needs to be. Because again, we're still lacking these areas, the same areas that you could have said we were lacking in during slavery. Nothing, you know, there hasn't been enough change. There's been change, obviously, but there hasn't been enough. Clearly, we as a community are not happy about the dearth of progress that has occurred, you know, over this long period of time. And at some point, you have to go back to the playbook and start to rewrite some things. You know, do we need to go back to this ancient text and take it quite literally? You know, is there another way we can go? So,
but yeah, you look at the Bible; it is incredibly pro-slavery. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't an accident that slave owners decided to try to force convert their slaves. That was very beneficial for them.
right. Absolutely. And the thing about that is, as I'm kind of researching for the book, and I'm having an opportunity to talk to other individuals, other Black non-believers about their experience, it's amazing how their mindset when they were Christians, when they were practicing Christians, how it's almost like their mindset was almost that of what I would imagine a slave would be. It seems so programmed because, you know, the programming came in a lot of different forms. For example, there was no questioning. As a slave, obviously you could not question. You know, you weren't free to, you know, have a civil discourse, you know, with your slave owner about, well, I don't know, should I pick this much cotton today? Like, there was no questioning. So, and it was that same type of questioning we instilled in our children early on. Do this, do not question me. With more being more specific when it comes to religion, this is Jesus, this is God, it's always been don't ask questions. And not only is that intellectually stifling for, you know, when it comes to the topic of religion, but just in general, just to think that there's things I shouldn't ask questions about. There's things in this earth that should not be questioned. Like, that shouldn't even be a thing. But that is a mindset that's set early on. Just let you know, young 5-year-old, there's things in this world that you should not question. When I say this, that's the end of the story. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a slave mentality, because somebody has to tell you that.
New Testament is littered with, you should be a slave of God. Right. And also, God chooses who's the leaders of the country.
Right.
Therefore, the racist asshole in the White House was put there by God. Right. And you just have to put up with it.
Right. Ask no questions about it. Just deal with it. There's no questions. I haven't been in a church since, you know, the current president's taken office, but I can only imagine I can imagine, because I was in the church when Bush was in office, for example, and I can remember some of the excuses individuals would make about some of the questionable practices and policies that were going on. And it's more so of, again, it's It, like I said, I go back to Christianity for us is a sedative. And again, it was used years ago, almost understandably for slaves, but now it's just gone, you know, it's gone way too far at this point. So people would say, oh, well, you know, yeah, this person's in office, you know, such and such in office, but we know who's really in charge, right? We know who's really in charge, and he's on our side.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, what evidence do you have?
Lots of justification.
Right. Right. It's, you know, that's the part that's frustrating. You know, I have absolutely no, you know, for me specifically, because I know there's, you know, atheists with different points of view, obviously, but for me specifically, I have no problem with, you know, a Christian in and of himself. You know, the majority of my friends and family are Christian. So I have no problem with that. But when you have a mindset that is, hindering and not helping a solution for our community, that's troubling, because it's affecting the community. If this is what you do in your household, I have no problem with that. I said, go forth, you know, it makes you happy, I'm all for it. But if we're trying to figure out, well, how do we increase finances? How do we do better with nutrition? How do we become better with education? You know, business ownership, home ownership, gang violence, things of that nature. And we have this made up half spiritual answer, like, well, Jesus will take care of it. You know, let's all pray. That's mm-hmm. unsettling. That's very unsettling because again, we've tried that for years.
Sticking your head in the sand.
Right. It's sticking your head in the sand. And at the same time, it's almost troubling. It almost goes to mental health, because it's turning away from what the issue really is. And so in effect, we're hurting ourselves. We're hurting ourselves by actually reframing the problem, by saying, okay, well, the problem isn't this person's in office, or the problem isn't, these particular things that, you know, that are really going on that we actually have evidence to show what the issue is. That's not the problem. The problem is, you know, there's a demon, you know, or something. When you phrase the problem incorrectly, you are more than likely not going to come up with the right solution. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we've been doing for 400 years is framing the problem incorrectly. So then because we frame the problem incorrectly, we're relying on a made up solution. You know, we're trying to solve the wrong problem. We're like, okay, well, if this is a demon problem, or if it's because, you know, if it's because God is testing us or making us wait, the answer is wait longer, because God just wants us to wait longer. The answer is Jesus is going to get us out of this one. Just wait and see. And then when we see the smallest, you know, the smallest amount of success, then, you know, we're so desperate to grasp at anything that looks like success. And even if it is, but it's still small, then, you know, we'll take that little bit and run with it. Like, see, well, you know, one black person became a millionaire. So, you know, there you go. We're all good. And again, we're tricking ourselves. I feel like we're hurting ourselves in our community. And I think that in the black community, Christians can still be Christians. You know, Muslims can be Muslims, atheists can be atheists. And I think everyone doesn't have to come to one specific mindset with regards to religion in order to solve these problems in our community. I think we can still have our individual beliefs, but still look at the problem in a more objective manner and make real time decisions and better results based on an open conversation about what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we do not do that. We have this spiritual conversation, which causes spiritual solutions, and then we get real-time raggedy results, and that's very disappointing.
Well, the church and the mosque could be used to help push that change. Mm. You know, it's not that hard for a church to throw a cooking class or right. to try to, especially if they're raising a lot of money, to put some of that money towards scholarships.
Right.
There are, or even just apply the expectation that, you know, you'll graduate high school or you'll go to college. It's amazing how well religious organizations can do with pushing that.
Right.
Absolutely. They just have to decide to do it.
They have to decide. I mean, you know, they're already a pretty well-oiled machine. I mean, that's, there's no question. I think there's over 70,000 black churches in this country. And if they all became, you know, the arbiters of, you know, education, for example, if they made that their one thing, for example, then, you know, there's no doubt that there would be significant change for the better. You know, I totally believe that. But again, you know, if we talk about the prayer closet now, if you're still in the prayer closet, that one wall of tradition is going to hold you back, because, you know, tradition is going to make you question some of these initiatives and how you go about it. So first, let me say, you know, the church does do or some churches, you know, do a commendable job of setting up some initiatives that, you know, attempt to solve some of the problems in our community. But at the same time, I've been privy to, and I've heard about through some of my interviews, some of the conversations that go on in a church if you decide to take a quote unquote secular route of solving a problem. Mm-hmm. So if they were to say, hey, you know, let's start supporting black businesses, you know, that there might be some of the higher ups in a church may think, hey, hold on. Like, you know, is this business of God? You know, is this something that, you know, the church is going to sanction? You know, that doesn't look too godly to me. I don't know. You know, that technology, I don't know. You know, like, again, that tradition wall, you know, can be a significant hindrance when it comes to making progress, because now not only does it have to pass just, you know, the general is this good for us test, but now it has to pass this spiritual test almost, you know. And again, it's like this made up line of defense. You know, you just add an extra layer of tests of a litmus test to actually have to pass in order for a church, you know, again, a well-oiled machine that has money and has ties to the community, before they move forward, it has to pass this other test. And again, I think that's extremely unfortunate. That tradition can be huge when it comes to what they do and what they don't do. And we have to break away from that. I think, again, for us to evolve as a people, we have to evolve out of some of those traditions. And a lot of those traditions are time-honored traditions that are rooted strongly in the church. And as long as it's held that way and regarded that way, I don't see the decision-making being radically different, you know, in the near future, unfortunately.
Do you think the degree of segregation in Christianity is a factor?
In what way?
Well, you look at, with very few exceptions, Adventists and Jehovah's Witnesses being the two main ones, mm-hmm. where they do have a high degree of diversity. Most of Christianity is, there are white churches and there are black churches, and they are generally different denominations.
Right.
Do you think that's part of the issue at play or not?
I don't think so, just because I think even if you remove even if you move Black people out of the tradition of a quote unquote Black church, if you will, I think Christianity, you know, religion in general, has its foothold in this country, has such a significant foothold in this country that that's enough to still throw the shroud of myth and tradition and fear, you know, over Black people's eyes, in order for them to still kind of continue the same trajectory that that they're on now. I think the division really just adds more of a nuanced approach. So again, like I was talking about earlier, how, you know, there's some certain things just in the community may not be looked at as, that's not Black, that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is more likely to fester as long as we have that division. But if you kind of took that away and, you know, kind of mixed it up a little bit more, a lot more than, you know, than it already is now in some churches, I think religion has such a strong foothold in this country that you would still have some of the same limiting results that we have right now. I don't think that would change. And I also think that the other thing that would that goes on now that wouldn't if we didn't have that division is some of those very specific conversations to our community, but that don't go anywhere. I've sat in the congregation and heard a pastor talk about mental health, like real mental illness, you know, what's PTSD or, you know, ADHD, depression, and then talk about it. And if you didn't believe, if you didn't understand the severity of those mental illnesses, you would definitely understand it after the pastor talks about it. And then in the end, the solution is, okay, guys, now that I talked about that, let's all pray about it. And you're like, what? Like, that's what we're going to do? Like, we're not going to really take a real... So those specific conversations, I think, would go on more or go on more now and would probably go on less if there wasn't that division. Because in the Black community, I think it's about, I want to say it's about 20% African-Americans actually go seek secular means of kind of alleviating mental illness, while in the white community is above 40. So, you know, so I can't help but to imagine, you know, what type of conversations are taking place in those different churches there. You're in a Black church, you have more just, let's just pray on it. Where I imagine, I don't know, but I imagine a white church, yeah, they may pray on it. But after that, it's okay, well, here's a number to someone you can really talk to now and, you know, go really seek some help after that. I prayed, so hopefully that'll help. But now you're also getting this, but now we're also seeking a secular means of assistance.
Yeah, I was a theology major in college, and part of the training was, we even had a class on how to do pastoral counseling. Mm-hmm. And the key focus of the class was on when you can't help and you need to refer somebody to an actual mental health professional.
Oh, okay.
Because it happens in white churches too, where pastors think they can solve everything. And that is very problematic.
Right, right. And like I said, I mean, I know a lot of these issues that the Black community are wrestling with obviously happen in a lot of communities. But as I was kind of doing some of the research for the book, I couldn't help but to look at just some of the numbers. And again, I didn't delve into it too deep because that's not necessarily the focus of the book, but I just touched on it just enough to understand the severity of some of these issues in the Black community versus other communities. And then when I look at the Black community's solution for some of these issues, again, that was troubling to me. So, to actually look at, again, not only the paucity of Black people that actually seek mental health compared in the Black community compared to the white community, but also look at the alarming rate in which Black people actually have to confront mental illness. You know, for example, you know, if you look on the news, you know, it was really, I felt like you still see it now, but it was really rampant, you know, probably about a year ago. And you probably hear about it more if you're just in any Black neighborhood about how many Black individuals are, you know, getting shot, you know, unarmed individuals are getting shot, things of that nature. You know, people don't, and you may have read some articles about it. Some of your listeners may have read about how, you know, a lot of that can cause PTSD, you know, within Black individuals, because for them, that's a reality. They're, you know, for a lot of people, it's like, oh, that happened over there. That's that other city over there is tragic, but that's nowhere near where I am. But for a lot of Black people, that's in their neighborhood. That's in their backyard. So, and they're like, man, if guy over here or young lady over here just got, you know, shot without a weapon, it's very realistic that can happen to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just on the news. That you know, what was on the news is right down the street from me. So that can cause PTSD, especially for younger folks who, you know, they're You know, it, again, you can imagine how it just may affect them even, you know, even more. And again, that mental illness and other mental illnesses as well, again, depression, ADHD, so on and so forth, tend to be more rampant in the Black community. I think it was roughly about 20% more likely to actually experience a mental health issue, including, like I said, depression, suicide, PTSD, ADHD. That's huge. And then that our main remedy is going to be, hey, let's pray for it.
Well, there have actually been cases where mentally ill men have been shot because they were having a bad day.
Right.
And if they had had somebody who was there who was equipped to deal with mentally ill or just people who are maybe off their meds, talk them down versus just shooting them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it would have been better. Well, something would have been better.
And if there's a decent chance that just walking down to the store is going to get you shot, that's going to be really hard to not develop at a minimum paranoia and anxiety. And if you're paranoid and anxious about the chance of a cop shooting you, an interaction with a cop is not going to be good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to speak to your point in terms of how do we deal with a mentally ill individual, I wasn't in church, you know, while some incidents that I'm thinking about were occurring. But I can only imagine if, you know, once that hit the news and, you know, that they're probably talking about that in the church, you know, the following Sunday, I can't help but to imagine how many pastors, how many people in the congregation chalk that up to, that person had a demon. And it's like, again, you know, if you ask the wrong question, more than likely you're going to get the wrong answer. If you reframe the problem in a manner that's not necessarily objective and fitting for what's really going on, then of course your solution is not going to alleviate the issue. And then we still have the issue going on. We still have the same issue. This is no different than what was going on in slavery, you know, PTSD and slavery. And then, you know, well, you know, Master just gave us this new thing called Christianity. There's just Jesus over here. Let's try that. 400 years is still not working. It's still not working. And again, that's frustrating. Then there's the individuals who simply can't afford any type of insurance, things of that nature, any type of health insurance. So you have the individuals who can but won't go, then the people who can't, who don't even have an opportunity to go. So again, and even when we do try to wrestle it, the best we got is Jesus. That's like our best, in our minds, that's the best shot is we got some Jesus, though, and we'll ride that all the way to the bank. And again, I have no problem with individuals utilizing that in their everyday life, you know, for their personal life, that gets you through your day. Again, I say more power to you. But when I look at us as a people, I, just like any other Black people, want to see us continue to strive and do more. I love that. It makes me feel good, you know, when I hear these success stories. I love that. I want to see more of that. But I feel like when I hear us using this handed down religion as our primary solution that has gotten us questionable results in the past, I can't help but to get a little saddened for the future. Like, is this what we're going to continue to do? Are we going to see more of this? Am I going to be 60, 70 years old and I'm seeing basically a repeat of the same stuff on the news? I'm going to turn on the news and, you know, more unarmed Black people getting shot, more information about how Black people are lacking in health, more information about how Black businesses are closing. Am I going to see the same stuff? It's depressing to me. I want to see us succeed. And I think that's going to take a change in mindset. In the book, I ask for individuals to, again, not become atheists necessarily, but just start to question some of the foundational elements that we've used to progress in our community. And one of those foundational elements is absolutely Christianity. It's absolutely Christianity. There was concerted efforts during slavery to make sure that we were weaned off of, you know, our African spirituality, and Christianity was used to not only control the slaves, but to also kind of rewrite the narrative of our place on earth. You know, it rewrites our place on earth. So control is huge because the slave masters saw that the slaves that were more likely to rebel were the ones that did not convert. You know, those are the ones that staved off conversion the longest. So they were like, well, statistically, I'm more likely to have a more productive and quiet and docile slave that's Christian. So I need to convert you to Christianity so I can, you know, go on about my business and have high productivity and high profits. So from a business perspective, it was worth it to make sure to ensure that we are converted. And then at the same time, it was important to understand our place on this earth, right? Because again, it's like, well, yeah, you're human, or they may see that, but I don't want you to know that. I can't allow you to think that you're equal to us. So I need you to understand your place, not just even in this country, but on this earth. Wherever you go, you need to know where you stand. So again, it was important to understand that, you know, like you alluded to earlier, like you have the Bible, and the Bible clearly talks about slaves and masters, and, you know, fearing your earthly masters as you would, you know, the master, you know, in heaven, and so on and so forth. And again, it said that, you know, they're like, hey, you know, this book, this other source here kind of tells you who you are. Clearly you're the slave. You know, we dominated you. So, and a lot of Africans took their enslavement as confirmation that the Christian God was more dominant than their African gods. So there you go. And I can't help but to think that mentality, or remnants of that mentality is, still kind of lingering, not in every Black person, but just in a lot of Black people in a lot of ways, that seep its way into facets of our life and who we are and who we are as a people. And again, that thinking differently, asking questions, you know, not to be defiant, but just because we want more, you know, and because it can be questioned. If it can be questioned, then question it. The more important the proposition, then question it. If this is supposed to be the most important thing, the most significant thing that rules everything on the earth, then it definitely deserves some questions. And if it's all that, then it will have no problem standing not only the test of time, but also standing up to my questions. So navigating those conversations, not only with people in my community, but like my kids, like I was talking about earlier, has been eye-opening and interesting. And I'm learning every day how to tackle some of those answers and in conversations, because by no means do I know it all. The only thing that was awoken in me when I had the opportunity to write this book was just the opportunity to start asking these questions that I never asked before, which started with, why do I even believe in God? Right. It all started with that one question, blossomed from there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, just keep your kids curious is all I can suggest, man. encourage them to question, and the next generation, you know, there's that just little glimmer of hope.
It's challenging, as you can imagine, in the South. It's everywhere. So my kids, every now and then, they'll stay at my parents' house, or they'll stay at my in-laws, and they'll come back. And again, they're both practicing Christians, and they'll come back, and this happened quite a few times. They'll come back, and we're about to eat, and they go, well, how come we're not going to bless the food? My oldest will ask that. And the youngest will be like, yeah, we didn't bless the food. and I'm like, well, guys, and again, my whole foundation for how to tackle, you know, religion with kids who don't know anything about this just yet is not necessarily to tell them what to think, but simply to teach them how to think. So for me, I tell them, so when you bless the food, I just ask them, because I'm also curious too. Like, you know, if they educated them on what that's supposed to be doing. So I say, well, why do you do that? And of course they don't know. And maybe they were told and just didn't remember, but you know, they say they don't know. And I say, well, what do I teach you to do, you know, once you sit down to eat? And they say, you know, thank the cook. And I was like, absolutely do that. You know, I was like, we don't bless any food here, but we absolutely thank the cook, you know, because, and I asked them again, I asked open-ended question. I want them to answer these questions. I was like, well, why is that a good thing? Because, you know, their mom cooks a lot, not because of traditional roles, it's because you don't want me to cook, because it just would be bad for the family. But they say, well, we thank mommy. And I said, okay, good. Well, why do you thank mommy? How does that make mommy feel? That makes mommy feel good. I was like, absolutely. Right. And then, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, I don't know who feels good just about blessing the food in general, but I know my wife appreciates when they go, thanks mommy for the, you know, specifically the, whatever they're eating at the time. And as you're eating, you go, this tastes good. You know, like, I assume when you go to someone else's house, or, you know, if you go to a restaurant, you know, if you were to say, you know, thanks to the chef or thanks to the person who made this food, that would make them feel good. That actually has positive change in community. That's a positive interaction. However small it is, that's a positive interaction that just occurred. Instead of everybody just kind of bowing their heads and doing this out of tradition, maybe you feel good. I don't know. But, you know, I imagine that positive interaction by saying thank you is a step in a different direction that doesn't happen often enough. Especially when you ask older people about young people today, they don't say thank you. They have no gratitude. Well, that's reinforcing some more of that.
Mm-hmm.
My son asked, who was God? Or he said, who was Jesus? One of the other. No, who is Jesus? Yes. And again, I wanted to tackle this a little bit later when he's older, because me being a history major, I can't wait to delve into some of the.
No, kid, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah, no, right? So the history lesson. But in the meantime, as a placeholder, I just told him, well, you know, Jesus is a person who may or may not have existed. And supposedly he did some really nice things for some people. And I kind of left it at that. I didn't want to say, well, he's a made up person and he's fake and he did these miracles. No, he didn't. He's not a fake magician. And I didn't want to go into all that. Again, I don't want to imbue my kids with the opposite of what other kids are instilled with, which is, you know, telling them exactly, specifically, you know, what to think, you know, when it comes to that. And I'm not knocking it because everybody's going to raise their kids differently, but I'm just saying, if I'm going to sit up here and tell people to, you know, ask questions and things of that nature, you know, I need to follow suit, obviously, not only with myself, but, you know, the way I'm teaching my kids as well. And I think that's huge because, you know, I'm hoping, if nothing else, when they get older, you know, they appreciate, you know, the fact that, you know, I simply taught them how to think so they can kind of mold their own path and their own thinking. And, mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of atheists, this might be true for you all and some of your other listeners. But for me, I think being told what to think early on when it comes to religion, is what causes a little bit of that anger when you first leave the faith. I did a speaking engagement a couple of weeks ago in Charlotte, North Carolina, great group. And there was one young lady who was clearly, you know, angry because she just left the faith. And her question was more of like a therapy session almost. She just kind of kept going. She was like, I just left the faith. And, you know, I still have some of these Christian friends and they say all these Christian things around me. And, you know, oh my gosh, I don't know. Do I just need to not be friends with them? I mean, you could tell there's a lot of, you know, vitriol there. And, you know, she went on for a couple minutes. And I think I asked her, I was like, you know, did you just, you know, recently, you know, become atheist? She's like, yeah, it was, you know, maybe 6 months ago. It was fairly recent. And I can imagine how she feels, because I kind of felt the same way. You know, like you feel like it was kind of thrusted upon you. You start thinking about all the what ifs, all the shoulda, coulda, wouldas. Like, man, I could have did this. Oh man, I missed this opportunity because I was doing that. And you were a little angry initially. And I'm hoping my kids don't feel that, because, you know, as much as possible, I tried to give them an opportunity to kind of mold their own path, and teach them how to think, and it'll be more of a authentic path and not this hand-me-down path that, well, this is what I did, so you have to do it. You know, I don't think anybody ever likes that, no matter what it is.
Very nice. So where can people find your book?
Yeah. So, the book is available, hard copy, and ebook is on Amazon. So that's Kindle for the ebook. And then also hard copy ebook on, BarnesandNoble.com as well. Which is for those who may use a Nook. So on both of those websites. It's also, it's published by Pitchstone Publishing. So if you go to Google Pitchstone Publishing, you can go in there and kind of see their catalog. My book would be there as well. So either one of those outlets is where you can find Emancipation of a Black Atheist.
Awesome.
Very nice. And are you going to be working on another one now?
Another book?
Yeah.
God, man, I am. Another project.
Oh, yeah, no, right? Man, I think more than likely, I have quite a few projects that I have in my head, but it won't be about this topic, about, you know, religion and atheism in the Black community. I'm kind of tapped out. Like, I love talking about the topic now that it's all done, but I don't think I want to do any more original research. I've read so much about it and interviewed so many individuals. I think I'm done with that. So, but
you put in the hard work.
Yeah. I put in the work, so I'll continue to talk about it. But any other books in the near future will definitely be about other topics that have just kind of been swirling around my head. So.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Great. Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. Nice to get some diversity on this show. Us over here in whitey tidy Idaho, we don't get a lot of that cross country perspective.
Absolutely. Nice. Well, again, I hope your listeners get something out of it. And for anybody that reads, you know, that does happen to pick up the book and read it, you know, I definitely welcome any type of feedback there on Amazon. I'm very curious to see what people think about my experiences and research and interviews as well.
Awesome. All right. And for our listeners, remember, not all those who wander are lost. Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.